I am the Great One, Son of the Great One, the Fiery One, Son of the Fiery One, to whom his head was given after having been cut off. The head of Osiris shall not be taken from him. My head shall not be taken from me. I am risen, renewed, refreshed. I am Osiris.
That was a quote from the spell to retain one's head in the Book of the Dead, talking about Osiris. We are featuring this word today on this episode of The Afterlife in 8 Words, a podcast written and produced by students at Smith College.
Hi, I'm Nora, and I'm joined by Josephine.
Hi there.
And Bella.
Hello, hello.
We're your hosts for this episode. Our podcast investigates the way in which religious traditions have conceived of an afterlife or a transformed existence that transcends this mortal life. And we do so in each episode by looking at one word that encapsulates a particular tradition's understanding of the afterlife.
Today, we are looking at the afterlife in ancient Egypt, and we are doing so through looking at a key word in this tradition, the name of Osiris. First thing first, who's this guy?
Right, so the short story is that Osiris is the name of an Egyptian god, but I know, since y'all are here, that you want the long story, so I will get right into the nitty-gritty. In the spiritual tradition, dating back to Egypt's early dynastic period at least, if not before, after the creation of the world, the gods Geb and Nut, the earth and the sky, had 4 children. These were Seth, Nephthys, Isis, and her brother-husband Osiris.
Brother-husband?
Yes, just roll with it. These gods have a terribly limited dating pool.
Fair enough, and Osiris was a big deal, right?
Well said. After all, his worship was one of the most enduring and popular in Egyptian culture, only edged out a bit by that of Isis. The judge and the lord of the dead, Osiris, was associated with fertility, agriculture, and the role of pharaoh in the afterlife.
According to myth, Osiris was a pharaoh, a kingly one, who aroused the jealousy of his brother, Seth, at the success of his rule, in which he taught agriculture, music, arts, and religion to his people.
Exactly right. As a result, Seth killed Osiris and took Egypt, but Isis, in her love for her husband, resurrected him through her powerful magic and returning his breath through the flap of her wings, the power of love.
Yes, but this romance does not end here, because unlike most murder mysteries, the gods can kill each other however many times they can commit to. Seth was determined and killed Osiris again, this time dismembering him and dispersing his body throughout Egypt via the Nile River, less lovey-dovey.
Still, murder number 2 didn't happen until after Isis conceived her and Osiris's son Horus, and eventually Isis restored Osiris's body, embalming him, and Horus avenged his father's death. Horus actually wound up losing an eye, which was then fed as an offering to Osiris.
This family had some interesting ways of expressing their feelings, didn't they?
To be fair, there are all sorts of various tellings of the story, so not all agree on every detail I just mentioned. But either way, the drama did not end with this conflict. After all of the gory stuff, Osiris withdrew to the afterlife, where he holds court. The soul of the deceased is weighed against a feather, and either granted salvation or condemned accordingly. Here's where Osiris became most relevant to Egyptians of the time. Osiris is synonymous with the royal afterlife, as much as the sun and the sun god Amun-Ra, one of the most powerful, prominent figures in the tradition in general, which I believe we will discuss more later. Osiris's story and figure represent several key ideals of the Egyptian culture of the time, though, including the divine power of Pharaoh, the triumph of order over chaos, the basic inspiration for virtue, and the promise of an afterlife in general to humanity.
Osiris was absolutely a central figure in the evolution of Egyptian culture and tradition. So let's talk a little bit more about that. The concept of power and authority in Egypt was a foundation stone for their society, and thus one of their most prominent gods is associated with power and judgment. Throughout the Old and Middle Kingdoms of Egypt, Osiris was strongly associated with Egyptian royalty, specifically the pharaoh. One pharaoh in the pyramid text was even referred to as O Osiris Pepi. The association with Osiris allowed pharaohs to demand and receive great reverence from their people.
That's right. As Osiris is the ruler of the dead, the association with power also created order and justice in the afterlife. Osiris's impact is visible on the upper class for sure. It must be noted that the pharaohs and the upper elites had a very material culture, so what remains of documentation on the afterlife from early Egypt is extremely biased in their favor. With the creation of the Book of the Dead, things really started to change, though.
Really? How so?
Well, the Book of the Dead was essentially a list of instructions for the afterlife. It was made in a booklet form for greater accessibility, so then the view of the afterlife from a more common perspective was well documented and preserved. From this point on, in historical records, Osiris became a symbol that really everyone could hold on to.
Wow, that's so cool. So there wasn't really any records of the common perspective of the afterlife until the Book of the Dead, because they had simpler ways of preparing for the next life. It's established that more people have hope that they can reach the afterlife and faith in Osiris, but how are things regulated?
Osiris has everything under control. The Book of the Dead describes the process of judgment that the dead must pass through, which we can describe more in depth later, and we touched on a bit earlier. But if they are of good character and pass their trial, the dead are presented before Osiris, and with his approval, they move on to the afterlife. So this sets up a system of justice and fairness.
I can also see how in this way, people would feel motivated to be better people during their lifetime in the hopes of making it into the afterlife. I know I would be.
I think it's important to note that Osiris' story developed a sense of humanity in his depiction. He's a perfect and supreme being, yet he's profoundly mortal. Far from the conception of an almighty and impervious being, Osiris' body has suffered and has been mutilated.
Yes, very good point. People are able to relate to Osiris through his pain and with his subsequent death. There is something comforting about a god who himself has experienced death and can sympathize with those who are feeling the same suffering and loss.
Osiris can be both a figure that people can look up to but also understand. He has great power and authority, but is also fair and just. He can relate to people on a human level and be the ruler of the dead.
Now, I am wondering, what concrete forms did the cult of Osiris take in the daily life of ancient Egyptians, Josephine?
Well, first of all, since Osiris' mummification enabled him to rise from the dead and live eternally in the underworld, the Egyptians believed that if they followed the same steps and rituals after their death, they could have the same fate. So the first thing to do was to mummify the body. The internal organs were removed, and the body was cleansed with oils and wrapped in many layers of white linen. In the myth, this recreated the unity of Osiris' body, which had been mutilated by Seth. But for ordinary people, mummification simply ensured that their bodies would remain in perfect condition, as they would need it to physically live in the underworld. Then, Isis performed magical rituals and recited spells to resurrect Osiris. Likewise, prayers and spells were recited to help the deceased person successfully journey to Osiris' court. Spells really were an essential part of Egyptian religion. We can find them written on the inner walls of the pyramids, or on the sides of coffins, or in the Book of the Dead. The Egyptians believed that these utterances had a real performative power. When these words were spoken, they made the described action happen.
Yes, spells really were something. And regarding funerary rites, I think it's important to note that they were not reserved exclusively for pharaohs. They were progressively extended to nobles and high-ranking officials. However, whether or not we can actually speak of a democratization of an afterlife is debated among scholars. For instance, costly offerings were perceived as crucial to enable the dead to reach the afterlife. As Horus offered his eye as food to Osiris, offering food was part of the funeral rites.
Yes, this is very true. The lower classes couldn't afford the lavish practices of embalming and offering gifts, and nor could they obtain, and let alone read, a copy of the Book of the Dead. However, financial means and magic rituals were not all that was needed to reach immortality. At the end of the day, faith in Osiris and a virtuous life were the ultimate criteria.
Yes, only the purity of the deceased person earned him his place in the afterlife. For instance, the negative confession in the Book of the Dead describes the scene of judgment in the Hall of Osiris. The deceased person first had to declare his innocence from sinful deeds such as, quote, "I have not impoverished the divine herd. I have not committed no crime in place of what is right. I have not explored nothingness. I have not done any evil," end quote. And then his heart was weighed before the eyes of Osiris. If it was lighter than a feather, the person was pure and could have an afterlife where he would live alongside the gods.
I do think it's funny because this negative confession that is supposed to prove the purity of a person strikes me as, I mean, I don't want to say unethical, but it seems to me, you know, that it's rote learning rather than a sincere expression of one's virtue.
That's a very interesting point. But whether or not we perceive this confession as ethical, it remains a great incentive to live virtuously, I think. On another note, rituals surrounding the Osiris cult were not limited to death and burial. For instance, two festivals were held annually, one to honor Osiris' death, the other to celebrate his resurrection. This festival followed the Nile River's flow. When the river receded, the Egyptians held the festival of the fall of the Nile. And when it rose toward the flood stage, they held a jet pillar festival. The Egyptians would go to the shore to offer gifts, little shrines were cast adrift on the river, and Osiris' priest poured sweet water into the flow. We can thus see that Osiris, as the god of fertility, was associated with the Nile. The river was indeed what enabled life, the cultivation of crops, and thereby the thriving of human affairs in Egypt. This life-giving power echoed the rebirth of Osiris.
It makes me realize that the myth of Osiris was actually just one big allegory for the fear that the Egyptians experienced daily, that the Nile would dry up, that fertility would disappear, and men with it. Indeed, Seth was the lord of the desert, so him killing Osiris symbolized the drought undermining soil fertility.
Absolutely, and it's fascinating how Osiris could encompass so many realms of life and take on so many roles. He was the lord of the dead, the great judge, the god of fertility. That reminds me of that agriculture thing we were talking about earlier. Osiris's skin is often depicted with a blue, green, or gray hue, and this actually represented the color of the fertile mud of the Nile River.
Yes, indeed. Ancient Egyptians saw things around them, the sun, the river, the wild animals, and they turned them into gods, thereby personifying the experiences they had with the surrounding nature. For example, the sun was personified as Amun-Re. This used to be the main allegory for eternal life, as the sun was seen to disappear every night under the ground in the underworld, only to reappear every morning as bright and powerful as ever. Therefore, it's interesting to see how Osiris, a simple man, could have become the lord of the dead. Nature was not anymore the only eternal force. Man could be too. And this gave hope to everyone that they could overcome death, that it wouldn't be the final step, but rather a new beginning.
Yes, absolutely. But then again, we can nuance everything because the Egyptian religion is so complex and also has evolved enormously over the centuries. Osiris was indeed characterized by his human mortal nature as opposed to the sun god Amun-Re, which represented an eternal superior force. But Osiris actually came to represent this natural force too. The Egyptians progressively distinguished three suns. Horus was the rising sun, Re the midday sun, Now, Osiris, the old setting sun.
Yes, you are right. And that reminds us once again that different people can see different things out of the same ones. In our culture, we see one sun. They saw three different suns, each with its own characteristics.
On that note, I think our podcast has reached its end. We have explored how Osiris is the key prism through which we can analyze the beliefs in the afterlife in the ancient Egyptian religion. His cult was so popular that it didn't simply cross all of the pharaonic dynasties, but it also spread into neighboring countries. For example, Osiris actually entered the Greek pantheon as Serapis.
Speaking of Greece, tune in next time for a podcast that will explore the word psyche in the Greek and Platonic traditions.
That concludes the show for today. Special thanks to Dan Bennett and Travis Grandy of the Smith Learning Research and Technology team. And thanks to the Andrew Mellon Foundation that supports public-facing student writing at Smith College. Our theme music is Lovers in the Night by Lobo Loco, used under an attribution non-commercial share-alike international license. Tune in next time on The Afterlife in 8 Words.